I want to take the opportunity to thank all the discussion leaders, the luncheon discussion leaders. I think they did a great job. All the tables were full, and I hope you all got your first choice. And if not, I hope you enjoyed your second choice topics. The first session this afternoon is Digital Preservation Readiness. Are we ready to preserve our digital assets? My dear friend Tom Clarison will be moderating this session, which we have three topics and four speakers for. All of these people are deeply involved in the activities associated with digital preservation. Many of their names will be familiar to you because they have years of experience between the four of them. So without further ado, I'll turn the podium over to Tom Clarison.
Thank you, Liz. It's always a pleasure to be involved in and participate in the WebWise conferences because we hear about innovations every February or March that will become standards in the field, actually some of the industry standards that we work by in cultural heritage. At WebWise in 2003, when the conference theme was sustainability, Vicky Reich gave one of the best professional presentations I've ever heard, and she was focusing on the LOCKS initiative. Today, one of our panel members will be addressing a statewide implementation of LOCKS. So how's that for sustainability? Good thing to take a look at. NEDCC, which has been long a leader in both education and consulting in preservation and digitization with their School for Scanning and a number of their other projects, will today be focusing on a combination of all of these strengths and reporting on its Digital Preservation Readiness Survey project. And we'll hear from one of the leading standards developers in the cultural heritage field on certification criteria for digital repositories. I think the thing that interested me as we built this panel was that the session is not just theory, but it's practical information and applicable tools that you'll soon be able to use. I'm going to go ahead and introduce all of our presenters and then let them take the floor. Our first presenter, Ann Russell, has served as Executive Director of the Northeast Document Conservation Center since 1978 and has served on the Board of Directors of Heritage Preservation and the Intermuseum Conservation Association, as well as on the Preservation Committees of the American Library Association and Society of American Archivists, where she currently serves as Treasurer. Anne will be discussing surveying the digital readiness of institutions and talking about some of the trends and findings from this survey program that's supported by IMLS. Robin Dale, our second speaker, is a program officer in RLG Programs, which is a part of OCLC's Office of Programs and Research. Previously, she was a program officer at RLG for over 9 years. Until this month, until actually February, Robin was also the project director of the Center for Research Libraries Auditing and Certification of Digital Archives project funded by the Mellon Foundation, which looked at developing processes to audit and certify digital archives and repositories. She co-chaired the RLG National Archives and Records Administration Digital Repository Certification Task Force, which produced the very recently released Trusted Repositories Audit and Certification, a checklist, also known as TRAC, and we'll hear more about TRAC as we go through the afternoon. And Robin will be talking about some of that work that she's done and some of those documents, discussing auditing and certification of digital repositories, next steps. And then Sue Medina, who will conclude our panel, is director of the Network of Alabama Academic Libraries, or NAIL. And NAIL's participants include all of Alabama's public and private nonprofit four-year colleges and universities. NAIL cooperative programs have significantly improved the delivery of library services and resources statewide. And with funding assistance from Institute of Museum and Library Services, NAIL is encouraging the development of Alabama Mosaic, a portal and digital collection of Alabama history. And I was telling Sue at lunch that one of the things that I do is point out some of their founding policies and their mission as some models that would be, I think, of interest to all of us in the room who are working on institutional or collaborative projects. Sue will conclude our session addressing the Alabama Digital Preservation Network, a statewide solution to preserving locally created digital collections. So I'd like to turn over the podium to our first speaker, Ann Russell, and ask you to welcome her and her presentation.
In 2004, IMLS made a museum leadership grant to NEDCC to develop a methodology for assessing the digital preservation needs of collections in museums as well as libraries. As a regional conservation center, NEDCC is concerned with longevity. And we were especially concerned about whether digital assets being created today would be around not in 1,000 years or 100 years, but even in 20 years. We made common cause with IMLS, which was awarding funds for digitization of collections materials and requiring applicants to provide a sustainability plan. We knew that applicants were having trouble with this question, as indeed was the entire field. For 30 years, NEDCC has been performing on-site surveys of the traditional preservation needs of smaller and medium-sized institutions. And as more digital materials were entering these collections, better? Okay. We saw a need for a whole new set of tools and skills for helping institutions with digital preservation. But these had not been developed yet. In carrying out the project, we worked in partnership with the Museum Computer Network, the Center for Research Libraries, the American Institute for Conservation, and Heritage Preservation. The idea was to bring digital experts together with preservation surveyors in order to share perspectives and come up with an entirely new procedure. The first activity of the project was to gather quantitative data on the status of digital collections in cultural heritage institutions. The data indicated that although 92% of institutions were already digitizing from source materials, only 29% had any written policies or plans for digitization. And while 59% of respondents said that their digital materials had a needed life of 25 years or longer, only 13% had any written policies or plans for digital preservation. This data suggested that planning for digitization was lagging far behind creation and confirmed our view that consultation was needed to help institutions relate their digital activities to their institutional strategic planning. In July of 2005, we convened a colloquium of digital experts and preservation professionals to look over the data and to work together to create a new survey tool. The group also looked at other survey models, especially CAP, the Conservation Assessment Program, which we found to be the most promising. Funded by IMLS and administered by Heritage Preservation, CAP enabled small museums to bring in conservation consultants to perform general preservation surveys and write reports identifying priorities. Heritage Preservation added value by screening the survey applicants and maintaining a roster of qualified surveyors. And they supported the surveyors through training, a manual, and online tools. The primary recommendation of the colloquium was that there was a need for a national technical assistance program on digital readiness. Participants felt that a written self-assessment tool would not be adequate, especially for smaller institutions, and that what was needed were expert-facilitated on-site surveys tailored to the goals and resources of institutions. They envisioned a program that would be funded by IMLS and other federal agencies, administered by a national organization which was perceived as neutral, i.e., not NEDCC, perhaps Heritage Preservation, and open to libraries as well as to museums. The next activity was to conduct testbed site visits in order to develop the new tools and procedures. 8 institutions were selected for pilot surveys, including 3 museums and, no, 5 museums and 3 libraries of different sizes and types. Each survey had 3 components. First, a questionnaire filled out by the survey recipients in advance of a site visit, providing background information about the institution and their digital activities. Second, the site visit, conducted by a team of 2 consultants, ideally one with digital expertise and one with survey experience. And in practice, our key surveyors are 2 people sharing the podium, Liz Bischoff and Tom Clarison. And the first step of the survey was to bring together staff for a group meeting that represented all of the departments involved in the digital initiative. Then the consultants worked with the contact person to gather more detailed information, interview key staff, and visit processing and digital storage areas. The third component was a written report documenting existing practices and policies and making recommendations for improvements. Although the sample size was small, the written reports provided very valuable qualitative information about the status of digital practices and digital readiness, which the surveyors have summarized in a trends report. They found that most institutions are in the project stage rather than the program stage of digitization, even those with sophisticated IT infrastructure. In general, institutions do not make digital preservation a part of their mission. Individuals involved in conservation and preservation do not have a role in the digital initiative. Most institutions store content on CDs or DVDs. Does that surprise you? And with a few moving to servers. Staff responsible for digital collections still believe that backup equals preservation, although the surveyors often found that the backup copy was kept in the same room as the master. The concept of a master copy that is never used for research and never used for making copies was poorly understood, and a need for staff training was observed at virtually every institution visited. And interestingly, we found a majority of museums and libraries are reluctant to collect born digital materials because they don't know how to accession them. As the project draws to a close, staff and consultants are focusing on producing written tools which will be beneficial to institutions and to future surveys. These will include the survey questionnaire, which can be used by institutions to measure their digital readiness, a surveyor's handbook, including a sample survey report, and the quantitative data we've gathered, together with qualitative data from the trends report. And all this can be found on NEDC's website at nedcc.org. The pilot surveys were carefully evaluated through questionnaires filled out by the survey recipients and comments and interviews with the surveyors. Surveyors observed, this must be Liz, that perhaps the greatest value was bringing staff together as a group, as this was a first chance to look at all of the units involved in digitization in a systematic way. The institutions themselves were very happy with the pilot surveys. 80% rated all three components of the project, the questionnaire, the site visit, and the report, as very useful or quite a bit useful. And 52 of the recommendations that were made across the various reports, according to respondents, 54% were discussed, and 48% were implemented or they are planning to implement them, which we thought was an excellent result. Leading the list of actions planned or implemented are implementing institution-wide best practices and investing in infrastructure to provide reliable long-term storage. The major challenge to the project was the lack of any available guidelines for digital preservation. As one colloquium participant commented, we can't tell people what best practice is, we don't even know what good practice is. So, for this reason, one of the final activities of the project will be surveying a few large institutions, not, in fact, the National Archives, but other large institutions that already have digital preservation activities underway, so that we can present a snapshot of the leading edge of current practice and perhaps identify some useful models. Since the long-term goal of our project is to contribute to an overarching national strategy for digital preservation, I would like to conclude by sharing the view of our project team as to what elements should be included in such a strategy. First, statewide solutions for long-term storage open to multiple institutions, like the Alabama Digital Preservation Network that Sue Medina will be describing, and backed up by regional centers of digital preservation expertise, since we're all believe what Steve Puglia says, that most institutions will not be able to provide digital repositories for themselves. More training and opportunities on digital readiness and digital preservation. And this is a little plug for NEDCC's next conference in Minneapolis in May. The real thing, a standards-driven approach to trusted digital repositories based on the critical work of the National Archives, the Research Libraries Group, and the Center for Research Libraries that Robin Dale will be presenting. And our group felt strongly that some heroic institution or groups of institutions should write a derivative version of the NARA RLG audit and certification checklist that could serve as a guide for best practices for smaller scale cultural institutions. The vision for a national technical assistance program based on the CAP model, but covering digital preservation, is still a goal of our group. And finally, advocacy efforts are needed to encourage 21st century institutions to make digital preservation a part of their missions. Free to all, and preserving the bitstream isn't true digital preservation. Does this sound like an ambitious agenda? Certainly, a lot of federal leadership, a lot of national oversight, and, by the way, funding will be needed to bring this about. And that's why I'm delighted that IMLS has signaled an interest in making digital preservation a priority. Together, all of us, working together, we can do it. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I should start off and preface by saying, excuse me, I'm in a slightly unenviable position here, and I should probably just make a confession at the outset. You've now seen Anne's beautiful presentation, and I've had the opportunity of previewing Sue's presentation. And so here's my big confession. I don't have any beautiful pictures in my presentation, even though I'm at an IMLS conference. I just couldn't come up with any that really just could capture auditing and certification. And unfortunately, any graphic designers in the audience? And unfortunately, the only digital audio that I'll be able to present or be able to give to you is that which is generated by this microphone. So just setting expectations and context now, I just wanted to try to quickly run through some of this, because I'm sure some of you are wondering why I'm talking about something that's sort of this really big and large effort, or an effort that's conceived of as really being only applicable to super large repositories. And what I'm here today, and what I want to make sure that I convey today, is the fact that this checklist, which was conceived of and designed by a lot of really large institutions, is also really applicable to what everybody's doing here. It's a part of a digital readiness plan, even if it seems tremendously overwhelming in its current state. I'm going to try to take about 10 or 12 minutes and tell you why I think it's actually completely perfect for what you need to think about. I mean, the first thing is really, I want to just run through issues about understanding what we mean by repositories, because even today at the Trusted Repositories table, we had different understandings of what repositories are. And the key thing here is thinking about repositories in terms of assessing and understanding risk to the data, because that's why we want to have repositories, not only to serve up the data, but enable to understand and assess the risk and be able to address that. I want to talk about why we think certification is actually really important, but even more so, I want to convince you why I think audit's important. I want to talk a little bit about the metrics that have been designed and the projects that were relevant as to in making these, so that you have resources you can go back to and that I'm not going to attempt to run through in a very brief presentation. And then the last part is I want to tell you about some big changes that are coming in terms of audit and certification and organizations that are responsible for this, as well as a set of tool sets that are being developed that might be able to further help you. So this is my this is what I tend to refer to as my soapbox slide. So I'm going to climb up on my soapbox here. And in thinking about in terms of digital repositories, and I'm thinking, let me just set the context. When I say digital repository, I mean essentially a digital preservation repository. So it can have a lot of services, but it ultimately, the ones that we're concerned with for certification have to do with being able to preserve the digital materials as well as serve them up. So we have a lot of people that talk about repositories and archives. We hear about data archives, and we're not quite sure how data archives are different from our digital object archives or repositories. And we hear a lot about large academic campuses building institutional repositories, and we're not necessarily quite sure how those are different from digital repositories. And if you're in museums, you're hearing about digital object management systems, content management systems, and digital asset management systems. And are those repositories? And if they aren't, why aren't they? And how do you get from one place to the other? And then we also hear about digital preservation systems, as if there's some package out there, there's not, that would do everything for you, and you just need to find it. Okay, so the problem is that what we have is this conversation about some kind of de facto network out there, but they're in varying stages of development. And not only are they in varying stages of development, but almost nothing will come to you. Nothing will come to you. Let me just remove that. I'll be absolute here. Nothing will come to you as a workable, out-of-the-box solution that you will be able to implement locally. It's going to take some help, which is why some of the other presentations have been very good to tell you that a lot of smaller organizations will not be able to, and I would argue should not take the time and effort to try to establish a local digital repository. You need to be working together and pool efforts like we've done on so many other projects, and you'll hear about over the course of the conference. It's not just digital preservation. There are all sorts of different kind of content, and there's different contexts for these repositories. If you're at a smaller institution, you probably aren't thinking that you're ever going to build that mass repository that major institution University X is building. And you know what? That's okay, because your context is completely different. Okay, so we need to begin to think about content and context and systems and come up with some level of common language, because I think Anne's presentation was very good to point out that a lot of people know that best practices should exist, but they don't know what they are, and they may not even know what good practice is, and it's the same case here. So having some level of terminology so we can move on. And in this case, in order to figure out what we're talking about, what our content and what our context is that we need to come up with some objective way, generally agreed upon principles, that we can audit and potentially certify digital repositories, archives, all of these things down the line. And audit is the key thing here. Now, audit is a really bad word to use, but it's very descriptive because we all have a pretty good idea what audit means. It's not April yet, but it's now March, and you've got about 45 days before you have to worry about another kind of audit. But it's a sort of very visceral kind of thing that we can think about. But the key thing here is, in order to think about trustworthy repositories, in order to have trust that your collections are going to survive and be able to be used and reused in different ways over time, is that we've got to be able to begin to develop these kinds of trust in not only our institutions, but in the other ones. One of the funny things I found out in going out and doing all of this audit and certification work, again, sort of one of the revelations that, similar to what Anne had, was, you know, I don't want to be audited, but I think everybody else should. That's a common thing that I hear about. Because institutions want to be able to trust that what their neighbor is doing is trustworthy enough so they can focus their efforts on their own collections. And we all realize that we're doing digital preservation in the context of a much wider network, because, of course, nobody can do it alone. So you want to be able to worry or not worry about what other institutions are doing. You want to be able to trust them. But trust comes through a level of verification and also a level of clarification of what you're doing. And it's an iterative process. You know, I can go in and I can audit any repository today, and I will guarantee you that if I come back a month or 6 months later, things are going to be slightly different, because development happens, collections happen, new things get added, new hardware and software come out, there are changes in staffing, all of those things happen. So we have to think about these evaluative processes happening as a part of a process, an iterative process. So when we're looking at these sorts of things, we're trying to look at institutional commitment. What is your institution promising it's going to be preserving anything over the long term? And I mean both implicitly and explicitly. Because if you're promising to be able to serve it up, you're essentially promising that it's going to be there for the long time. And you need to think about your institutional mission statement and the commitment that it's giving. You need to think about your intent for collections and whether your intent will be the same for the lifespan of the institution, the collection. Will things change? Will you want to somehow either increase or decrease commitments to collections? And the kinds of objects you have, these all have to be part of your larger strategy and therefore your larger plan and what you're putting into your digital repository and how you're managing it over time. You need to think about the infrastructure demands that will be there, both organizationally but also in a technical sense. What kind of commitment is there to a solid technical system and how it's going to need to grow and change over time? What about your staff? If you currently have one web person or two web people and you don't have system developers and things like that, I'm going to say that there's probably a small staffing problem there and things need to change, but these are things that you can begin to do. If you look at the context of what you're doing. If you look at the kind of funding and technology you have and that you may be able to get and budget over time, then you also begin to set the context for the kind of repository and preservation that you'll be capable of. You begin to be able to think about and communicate the potential risks to your collection both now and in the future as things are developed or you join a part of a collaborative effort. You know, the thing we don't like to talk about is the funding that people need and those sort of business phrases that are creeping into our vocabulary more and more. First, it was just things like ingest. That wasn't business. That was sort of the medical thing. We didn't like that. And now that we're looking at things like return on investment, what is the return on the investment? And it's really hard to think about preservation and digital preservation is there's really a sort of return on investment. And if you aren't able to preserve things, what are the risks? And how can we communicate the risk to content and then be able to build systems into that? So these kinds of audits will help you in future planning, not only where you're going with a repository, but if you have one in place, what kinds of things you'll need to have. If you don't have a repository or you're looking to build something, either hopefully not on your own, depending upon sizes, but collaborating with other organizations, whether it's regional, consortia, statewide, you need to think about what the best practices are. And then you need to sort of do what I would term to be a gap analysis, another sort of businessy thing, where you look at what practice is and then you look at what you're doing or what you hope to do, where you look at procedures and figure these things out, and you can begin to have some level of comparison and find out what you have, what's missing, or what you are doing more than you than is sort of a baseline expectation. So map those practices against local goals and local capabilities. And then think about where you need, as I said, where you need to go. But the most important thing to think about, even though I've said system, preservation, repository, and all these things all the time, is I really need to emphasize that a trusted digital repository needs to be seen as a holistic system. So now holistic and iterative. It's not just the technical bits, it's not just the system driving the preservation, but it's really about your organization. Like I was saying before, your funding, your staffing levels. What is supporting the preservation? You know, you need to have people that are doing that. You need to have funding. You need to have backing and support and things, missions and goals that tell you this is your, you're supposed to be doing this. This is your mandate. You need to have some system or combination of systems because it doesn't only have to be one. A lot of institutions are using a lot of different options right now. So what's managing, what's the digital object management system that's doing it, and what kind of technical system do you have in place that's supporting that management? You notice that if you've ever looked at the checklist or thought about it, it doesn't tell you what system to use, what hardware and software to use, or anything like that. That's on purpose because who was it? Somebody was saying, I read it somewhere, somebody blogged about this yesterday about standards, and they said something about standards are a lot like toothbrushes and that, you know, everybody thinks they're a good thing, but no one wants to share one. It's the sort of same thing, it's the same thing about digital repository implementation. Everybody thinks they have good things and they really want one, but no one is ever going to implement it the exact same way. So you have to, so we're never going to provide that kind of prescriptive advice on here. So these are just general advice pieces, and we need to think about this when you're creating and evaluating digital repositories. We have to realize, because of this, that good repositories will differ. You can be trustworthy and not be just like your neighbor, because there are some really solid common things that are the same across. Good practice is the same. Good policy is the same across the board. But here's the big key. They really need to be sized to meet your local goals. Absolutely any sort of digital preservation and what you're planning to build has to be sized to meet your local context. You don't want to try to build this huge, huge repository that's incredibly complicated if you're not a massive institution that's going to be dealing with all different kinds of things. Size it and try to evaluate it in the context in which it lives. Otherwise, all of these checklists and different sorts of tools seem like they're unsustainable for you. You need to look at it from a local context. You need to identify where you're going to do things differently from where other people do, because knowing why you're doing something is just as important. It's okay to disagree Intelligent people can agree to disagree, but we can have an argument and justify why we're doing that. And that's also really important because that it gets to the trust. You're clarifying why you're doing something. There may be a very good reason. But the last thing is that audit is really just meant to be some sort of objective evaluation that we can all agree to. It's a set of guidance. It's a set of principles and things that we can do. It is and does allow this sort of risk assessment about the objects that are under care of a certain repository. It allows us to think about the capabilities of the people and the systems that are running it, and it begins to lay the groundwork for this trust and for this collaboration, whether it's an implicit or explicit collaboration that we have in mind at the time, because it is about this transparency. It is about exposing risks, and it is about thinking about this long-term concept of stewardship and what are these institutions doing to promote the long-term stewardship and persistence of the materials. Okay, so actually winding up here, see, I said no pictures. There was just nothing to really do here. But we did have a really fun acronym. because the whole RLG, NARA, audit, checklist, certification thing, we've had some trusted digital repositories, TDR, back and forth. So now we're just getting on track. So the new document, we tried to create, literally, did the UK way of approaching a titling a document. We came up with an interesting acronym and then made the words fit from there. So TRAC is a new document, and it is the next, and I should say the next version, version 1.0 of what used to be called, alternatively, the RLG NARA audit checklist or the Trusted Repositories checklist. And so it combines the earlier work, and it also, of that joint work, and it also combines it with the Center for Research Libraries project, and a lot of good advice from some really smart people, many of whom are in this room. And it retools the previous checklist into only three sections, and it so the sections are, not surprisingly, since I've dwelled upon them in this presentation, organizational infrastructure, object management issues, technical infrastructure and security issues, so the sort of hardware, software, security environment. And that document will be out imminently. It's been ready for a couple weeks, and we're just getting it lodged in the appropriate server and creating the appropriate press releases and things like that. It may have been announced today. I'm not quite sure. Another thing that's kind of interesting and not quite as applicable for museums in this case, and I do apologize, but I want to point this out from the beginning. This catalog of criteria for trusted digital repositories came out of a German group, the Nestor group. And if you search on Nestor, do an internet search, you can find that. But it's interesting because it starts from a much lower level of things that mostly academic, state, and archival institutions in Germany will need to prepare on and to meet the German certification that the federal government there is trying to create. The next one, the Digital Curation Center and Digital Preservation Europe, which is a European Commission project, is taking some of these metrics and creating a risk-based evaluation tool, which is something I think might be of interest. So if you're not looking for the planning, but you really want to look at evaluating the risk to your collections and how you're managing things, that might be a really interesting tool for you to look at too, and it's due out imminently. And then finally, this last thing, all of these groups have been working together well. We went ahead and got together this group of 10 principles. So I think this information is coming out too. So it's sort of the Cliff Notes version to everything else. And then finally, just to sort of wrap things up and let you know, sort of another big announcement. The audit and certification work will actually, with the publication that's coming imminently, any day now, will move from what's now RLG programs and OCLC to the Center for Research Libraries. And as Anne described, there is some other work underway to then try to take, not only keep this Trusted Repositories document up and running, but also try to retool it for smaller institutions. And I think that that's a really valuable thing, and I encourage that. Hopefully they'll be able to get funding to do that. The risk-based analysis, audit, and assessment tool, and an entire toolkit on how institutions can use this will be coming out of the Digital Curation Center and Digital Preservation Europe. Nestor is developing training tools that will be applicable to all in both German and English, make it a little bit more helpful for us. And then finally, they're also driving the checklist into an ISO standard for those people that are really into being able to document international standards. So that'll use all of the checklists combined and create the official ISO standard catalog. And I tried to put this in your document, and a lot of them say not yet available, because when I submitted it, it was pretty much true. But the 10 principles document will be on the Center for Research Libraries site. The toolkit is due out, I think, this week from the DCC. Nestor is available, and the citation you have in your book. And then the last one, the Center for Research Libraries, will be the home of the other site. Thank you.
It's always so wonderful to come to WebWise and be inspired by everything that happens and go back and think of ways of how I'm going to apply it. And I can tell you next August when it's hot and humid, I'm going to be thinking about sub-zero dry storage. In 2001, the Network of Alabama Academic Libraries received an IMLS National Leadership Grant to create a digital collection showcasing Alabama history. While the leadership for this effort came from the academic librarians, we felt that it was very critical that we encourage our local repositories, no matter where they were located in the state or who was responsible for them, that they contribute digital copies of their treasures to Alabama Mosaic. And one of the services we offered was hosting. If you're a local small repository and you want to do it digitally and you don't have the equipment and software to do that, then we will host your digital, your web presentation files and your metadata for you as part of what we offer on Alabama Mosaic. Our criteria for participation included a responsibility that the local repository needed to take to archive their own digital objects. And I'm going to go through very quickly some slides that stress to us in Alabama why archiving is important. But in working with those local repositories, so many of them staffed by Uncle Henry, all of you know Uncle Henry, he retired several years ago and now he does good at the local history museum. And we could see his eyes glaze over when we talked about preservation. And we just learned that archiving and concern for archiving was not in their lexicon. And furthermore, if they thought about archiving, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. We'll check that off. We'll be responsible for that. They didn't have an off-site means facility that could take care of their archives, or they didn't have funding to pay for off-site storage. So as we promoted Alabama Mosaic in the academic community, where you think you have all the resources of an academic institution, we discovered a wealth of wonderful digital collections that were being created by faculty and students. And one of the stars for me was an effort of the faculty at the College of Agriculture to digitize the herbarium specimens. And to this day, I don't know where they are. They have sort of vanished. And these were being stored on desktop PCs. They didn't have any backup plans. They weren't part of the University Computing Center backup plans. No one was even thinking about digital archiving. Many of them, I think, probably walked off with the student as part of a student project. And we realized that all of these resources were at high risk and that we needed to do more than just say, on this checklist, you need to take responsibility for archiving your digital objects. This was given impetus to us by Hurricane Katrina. Even though we've had some experience with hurricanes, we're right in the hurricane alley and the tornado alley and the flood plain. All of these are very common to us. Fortunately for the Network of Alabama Academic Libraries, we've never lost a major academic institution, but we certainly have watched some of the public libraries and school libraries blow away or flood away. So as we were talking about the need for a solution, Aaron Trehub, who's here with me today. He is the project director for the Alabama Digital Preservation Network, told us about the effort of the Meta Archive for Southern Digital Culture, and that they were using locks to, they were identifying and then using locks to preserve at-risk collections. And this seemed a perfect solution, and he presented that to our digital content committee, and they mulled it around. We don't do things real quickly in Alabama. We mulled it around for a while and ultimately developed the concept for the Alabama Preservation Network. And we came back to the Institute of Museum and Library Services and said, while we thought we had the perfect grant for Alabama Mosaic, we do have to alter it a bit and would like your assistance, and they very graciously agreed, to create an archival piece to Alabama Mosaic. But we broaden that to again say that it would not only be an archive for the Alabama Mosaic contributors, but also an archive for any repository in the state that was making digital collections publicly available. And we, thanks to Aaron, looked at locks and thought that that would be an ideal solution for us, and that we wanted our preservation network to be state-based, distributed, and in Alabama, where we don't have enough money for anything, low-cost, and that we could propose a model for the long-term archival preservation of our locally created digital assets. Our goal is to offer a trusted archival storage service for cultural repositories of all types that make their digital collections freely available to the public. And obviously, we're going to stress participation in this with our Alabama Mosaic contributors, but we also hope to get some of our state agencies to participate, and we would even consider for-profit organizations if they are making their resources publicly available. We've had calls from libraries out of state asking, can we participate? Would you expand this? And we're at this point really staying focused on this state identity. For one thing, hopefully that makes it easier for us to go to the state legislature and make a justification for funding. Now, why did we choose locks? Lots of copies keep stuff safe. And I first learned about locks through the International Coalition of Library Consortia, and it was developed primarily for commercial e-journal content. All of you who are licensing commercial content know that the publishers have been slow to take responsibility for archiving their own publications. And this was a solution that librarians came up with to make sure we would have perpetual access to the materials that we have licensed. And as locks became more robust, it became apparent that this was a really good solution, not just for e-journal content, but for the locally created digital materials as well. And I'm not going to spend any time about how Locks works. They have a wonderful website. I strongly urge you to go and read about it. But essentially what you do is store the same content in multiple caches or locks boxes, and those servers communicate with each other in a slow web crawl to say, this is what I have. Does it match what you have? And they are constantly monitoring themselves to make sure that the integrity of the content is maintained. Each of the ADPNet servers will retrieve the local content from the local repository server, or we are going to have a hosted server as well. And then after that content is retrieved, we'll continually poll themselves. We have 7 servers, and the challenge we put for ourselves as a state-based network was the capability of diverse organizations to participate in a statewide, cooperatively managed preservation solution. And I want to talk briefly about my partners. Auburn University, University of Alabama, and University of Alabama at Birmingham are our 3 largest academic institutions. They have fully staffed digital collection programs. They're doing everything right, we hope. We hope the audit says they're doing everything right. And obviously they're positioned for leadership in this kind of a cooperative organization. Then we looked at for some other institutions who would give us a flavor for how other institutions might be capable. Troy University is a growing university, and all of their computer support is provided from the computing center, and libraries on a list of 1 to 200 would be about 145. We just feel like institutional priorities are going to trump library needs, and so we wanted to play with that. Spring Hill College is a very small, 1,200 FTE Jesuit college. They have a part-time systems person. They share him with the local public library. And so we wanted the challenge of if you're really small, but you have a terrific collection that needs to be made available, how would you participate in a statewide project? University of North Alabama is a very small, but fortunately very stable institution. And its library and computing center are under the same director, and they have a lot of staff in common. And so we thought, here's one that everything is fully integrated in terms of the technology and the librarians. And so what would they bring to a state network? And then the State Department of Archives, which is a critical important partner in terms of content, they have to do everything through our state data systems, and believe me, they don't even want to hear the word library. So they're going to be an interesting partner for us. And, of course, low cost. Alabama's a poor state. We talk about educating orphans and widows, and we don't have a Bill Gates. And so we chose Lonx because it has a very low-cost initial startup. You can use equipment you're getting ready to send off to surplus. It requires, once it's up and operational, requires almost no technical administration. They're going to poll themselves, and hopefully they're not going to turn on the little key that says, ooh, come pay attention to me. And so we want on the infrastructure side to keep it low-cost because ultimately we think that we're going to have to build in some kind of fee-based ongoing support, and so we didn't want to have to buy into an expensive infrastructure. And low cost is going to be critical as we work with these small local museums and public libraries. Low cost for them is really going to probably be no cost. Long-term storage, this is a dark archive. We never want to take anything out of it. It's my responsibility when there's a hurricane warning to wish it either east or west of Alabama. We feel that the community at large will find us to be reliable and trusted. The academic institutions and state archives do have good reputations in Alabama for doing things well. And most of all, we want to be stable. Once we get this up and operational, we don't want to lose it down the road. For any reason. Another of our challenges, and this is part of our project, is that we are going to have to create a governance structure of how can we democratically manage this network. And for now, Aaron Treehub is our czar. While we have the IMLS grant, he's our project director, and he gets to tell us what we're going to do. But we're going to really work on the governance structure so that we can exist long term. And I want to say that we are very grateful to the Meta Archive for Southern Digital Culture because they're doing this on a regional basis, and I anticipate that we will build what we're doing much on what they are. And facing us very quickly is adopting policies and procedures for the network and adopting our sustainability plan and whatever funding requirements we're going to need. And that's it.
I think that the direction that we're going, the idea of documenting institutional policies and practices in digital preservation is something we started talking about this morning and are seeing a variety of ways that institutions are doing that. Is preservation or digital preservation in your institution's mission statement or in their practices? Is it documented there? Are you committed to digital preservation? You need to ask yourself that or maybe is being committed to digital preservation, getting you ready to be committed because you have to think about it so long and hard. So thinking about that is important as well. And then the model that we talked about, especially with Sue's presentation, but throughout all of our presentations so far this afternoon, is following very closely on the ideas of consortial and collaborative approaches to digital preservation, which were discussed by Steve Puglia and Gunter this morning. So I think we're going to see this set of themes reflected in many, if not all, of our presentations during the conference. With that in mind, are there questions of our three presenters that any of you might have?
Hi, I'm Marcia Semmel from IMLS, and my question's for Robin. You talked about sizing your digital repositories for local needs, and I'm wondering, as these audit metrics have and planning metrics have been developed, where and how either current or potential audiences are figuring into the equations. I know you didn't get into the substance of a lot of the metrics, but I'm very curious about that question. Thank you.
Just checking to see that was on. So anybody who saw the very first version, which actually should be more people than have seen the version that we haven't managed to get released yet, I guess, will notice that there was a section in there that we tried to quantify on users and usability and things like that. And actually, and in my mind, more correctly, we've eliminated that as a specific section because we think that calling that out as something different is not the way to go. That, and it makes it seem like it's a separate set of decisions and thinking about audiences and things, and when in reality it needs to be in at every level of decision that's made about digital repositories, from, you know, basing everything about the context of your organization and the users you have and things like that, and then making sure that plays out entirely through an audit, making sure that your community, your user community of the repository and of the content is consistently the focal point that drives the future bits, the next development, the why you're doing what you're doing. So in the sense of audience, I want to make sure I'm addressing your question correctly, in the sense of audience, it's not called out anywhere in the checklist to make sure you that there's a special section, but that you know that from the very beginning, from planning in day one. That's the only way you're going to have a successful and reliable repository, is if you have it for an audience of users that you can gauge their expectations and gauge your success based upon that context. Did that answer your question?
Other questions?
Jane Cullinane, Connecticut State Library. My question is for Sue. I find very appealing your low-cost surplus equipment solution, but I was wondering what thoughts have you had about the problem of formats becoming obsolete and equipment, and what thoughts you've had about dealing with format and equipment obsolescence?
I'd be happy to try to answer that. I'd like to repeat something that Sue did stress in her presentation, and that is the degree of our debt to the NDIP meta-archive project. I mean, really, what we're talking about doing in Alabama is an attempt to replicate, in a slightly different way, what NDIP meta-archive has done for six southeastern universities for southern digital culture. We're trying to do something similar for the state of Alabama. And format migration was to have been the follow-on stage to what MetaArchive has achieved so far. As I'm sure many or most of you here know, the NDIP program, funding for that has been rescinded, so things are a little bit up in the air at that point right now. But I guess that's a long-winded way of saying we don't have an answer for format migration yet, but it looms very, very large on the list of issues that we hope to address in the coming years.
And I would add to that we think that's a can be more realistically solved collectively, that if we have a lot of institutions that have a format in the archive and we have to get it out and reformat it, that we can more realistically come to a single acceptable solution than 20 institutions coming to 20 separately developed solutions.
And just a word about equipment. We're not actually running this on beige boxes, although you can. We're looking at servers that are in the price range of about $1,700, $2,000 per server. We're looking at an initial network size of about 1 terabyte storage, which we think will be adequate for the first stage of material that people would like to have harvested on the first pass. And we're sure that that will grow. So that running, you know, proof of concept, see if it'll work, and take it from there.
Yvonne. I'm Yvonne Carrigan, University of Maryland Libraries. And is there a good model for a digital disaster plan on the NEDCC website or on DPLAN or someplace else?
Lori, can I defer to you?
Yes.
I want to just add one comment to that. Katrina, in trying to deal with getting some of the computer backup, university computer backup tapes out of New Orleans, they encountered the situation where the service that picks them up couldn't even get to New Orleans because the roads had been reversed. So the people who had backed those tapes up and were expecting them to be picked up, you know, came back 2 weeks later to the tapes still sitting there. So we're seeing many, many more contingencies than we ever thought initially. But there is excellent disaster planning training out there, and I would strongly recommend that you get as many people enrolled and participating and working these out and then coming back and training people locally. And look for people who are resilient and flexible.
Can I just say, my colleagues and I actually do disaster planning, so I'm not talking about general analog library disaster planning. I'm talking about a digital disaster plan. And so I didn't know if there was something different than what I'm used to. But we're very familiar with the usual library disaster and archival disaster planning.
I think I could step in to just talk a little bit about some of the things that we found that are starting to work in the digital survey activities. The idea of building up planning and policy documents for all aspects of the program is important in case you need to replicate it, first of all. The idea of redundancy and offsite storage of data as well as offsite storage of some of the original materials is important as well. Testing the plan, certainly, is something that the institutions that are starting to move toward success in digital disaster planning are working toward. And then the whole idea that Sue mentioned, New Orleans Commission and a number of other areas, that communication and trying to find out where the bits and the people regional-wide, like Katrina, is something that very few of us have in our plans and very few of us are taught, so that we need to build that in. I do know that in the computer industry, just to name one organization that has done some training of people who are putting together some of the third-party repositories and other digital preservation activities, a company called SunGuard is one group that has done some level of training for people who are putting together repositories in the records management area and in the library and archives area as well. Robin, do you have other organizations that you know of who are doing this type of disaster planning or can help institutions with that, with digital disaster planning?
Not a lot. I mean, there are a variety.
variety of companies selling services as the disaster plan in the sense of backup, but not facilitation and creating.
So I think that that's something that, as Yvonne and others of us in this room who are responsible for delivering training, this is another component we need to build into our training activities. Helen.
Helen Thibault, School of Information and Library Science, UNC Chapel Hill. This is my second day of trying to mention the conference that we're going to have in April, 18th through 20th, which is the DigSeeker Conference. IMLS funded, part of a larger grant that I want to talk about. And our theme is looking at what digital curators do and what they need to know, because the larger grant funded by IMLS is to build a digital curation curriculum. And what I didn't mention at the pre-conference yesterday was that we also have fellowships for students starting in the fall, two-year fellowships. So if you know anyone who should apply for this, please have them send an application to School of Information and Library Science at UNC as soon as possible. I think our deadline is the 15th of March, and we are getting applications in. Robin, you talked about audit and certification and all those documents that are imminent. We have used the first draft version, not first version, but the draft version of the RLG one at UNC in looking at our own, building our own institutional repository. But Callie and I are finding this useful in trying to figure out what it is that digital curators need to do and to know. So I guess the question is, you said that Nestor was building training tools, presumably for people who will be working in the field. But we're looking at the, not kind of the continuing education side of it, but the graduate level education side, and would love to work with this whole range of documents and people involved in this from an educational, develop the curriculum kind of perspective.
I'll set you up with Susanna Dobratz, who's okay.
Any further questions for our panel? If not, I'd like you to join me in thanking our panel, and thanks to you for your questions.
We're going to transition panels. If you would like to just stand up and stretch, this is not a break yet, but please take an opportunity. We'll do some stretches. The next panel is going to be a new panel for us. We've never done this before. It's the Washington Update panel.